stopped to catch their breath just in front of Dunk's Woods. Grandpa handed the jar with the last bee in it to Mary Ellen, and she let it out. Sure enough, it flew straight and low, right into the woods. "It's the bee tree," Grandpa whispered. "That's where the honey will be, but we'll need plenty of smoke." Everyone set about to build a fire from twigs and damp leaves. When the smoke had quieted the bees, Grandpa balanced on Einar's bicycle and reached into the tree. As he pulled out small pieces of honeycomb, he dropped them into some of baby Sylvester's spare clean diapers that Klonda Bertha was holding. Mary Ellen tied them into neat little bundles, and Mr. Lundhagen put them into the baby carriage. The musicians played merrily as the Herman sisters danced. Grandpa invited everyone back to the house for baking powder biscuits, fresh brewed tea, and of course the honey. There was music, dancing, tall tales, and raucous laughter as they all buzzed about the sweet adventure of the day. Grandpa took Mary Ellen inside away from the crowd. "Now, child, I'm going to show you what my father showed me and his father before him," he said quietly. He spooned the honey onto the cover of one of her books. "Taste," he said, almost in a whisper. Mary Ellen savored the honey on her book. "There is such sweetness inside of that book, too," he said thoughtfully. "Such things, adventure, knowledge, and wisdom. But these things do not come easily. You have to pursue them. Just like we ran after the bees to find their tree, so you must also chase these things through the pages of a book." Then he smiled and hugged her. From that day on, Mary Ellen never again complained about her reading. She found it to be every bit as exciting as the wild chase through the Michigan countryside and as sweet as the honey from a bee tree. That's the bee tree.
Thanks, Holly. Our presenter today is DJ Hall. She's the managing editor of Wisconsin Watch, a nonprofit investigative news outlet based at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Prior to founding Wisconsin Watch with her husband, Andy Hall, Dee was a reporter and editor for 24 years at the Wisconsin State Journal, specializing in projects and investigations. Please welcome Dee.
Hi, everybody. Really appreciate you having me here today to talk about something that it turns out is a lot more important even than when we first talked about having this particular session. We have been neck deep and knee deep in this disinformation problem for quite a long time now. I'm going to share my screen. I realize now that I need my script, so I might be flipping back and forth, which is not ideal. I think I should probably just perhaps print out my script. So what I'd like to do, I'll just talk for just a second while I go ahead and print it out, because I realize you're not going to want to see my script. That's rather boring. I can tell you a little bit about us. We are based at the UW-Madison. As you just heard, we're on the fifth floor of Vilas Hall, which is in the journalism program. We work very closely with students and young journalists, helping to train them to become investigative journalists. My husband and I worked at the Wisconsin State Journal for many years. I hesitate to tell you how long, but Andy Hall, my husband, was there for 18 years and I was there for 24 years. It's likely that if you get the State Journal newspaper, you read one of our stories over that long period of time. And then in 2015, I left the Wisconsin State Journal and I started working directly with the Investigative Center, which we had started back in 2009. And so I have been there now since 2015, working as the managing editor. We are growing, which is wonderful. I know a lot of news organizations are not growing. We are shrinking, or they are shrinking, but we are growing. It is a really rough time for journalism, as you'll see. That's part of the presentation I'm about to give. So thanks a lot for giving me this opportunity to share the story of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, the state of journalism, voter suppression, and disinformation. It's a story of challenges, economic as well as trust, imperiling journalism and our democracy. It's a story of hope, too, as nonprofit and for-profit news organizations and people in communities across Wisconsin and America step forward with solutions. I'm going to try to make you guys really tiny on my screen. Okay. In the old days, your trusty newspaper arrived at your doorstep. You had little reason to question whether the information in it was accurate or where it came from. Nope. Sorry. But technological and economic forces, including the emergence of the internet, have drastically reduced revenue to newspapers. Stores and businesses now can reach their customers directly. Many no longer need the local newspaper to get their messages out. Many news consumers prefer to get their information on their phones, tablets, or laptops. And newsrooms are now half the size they were just in 2008. So here you can see the drastic decline in the number of newsroom employees, specifically newspapers. Over the past 15 years in Wisconsin, 77 newspapers have closed. Circulation is down by 1 million. Many newspapers, as you can see, are just gone. And what happens when newspapers die? Here's what researchers have found. There is less voter turnout, fewer competitive races for office. Voters don't know who's running for Congress. Government waste increases when reporters and the public aren't watching. Businesses feel free to pollute and regulators feel free to look the other way. And so when fact-based news disappears, residents start to get information from biased sources instead of nonpartisan ones, which hardens their political positions. The bottom line, no news is bad news for democracy. Trust in media also has declined, although it's a bit better than it was in 2016 at the height of the Russian disinformation campaign. Media that report only one side of the story further erode that trust. Millions of Americans get their news exclusively from Fox News on the right or MSNBC on the left. This split makes viewers unaware of or hostile to perspectives different from the ones they see on TV. And what they see is often not reporting, but commentary. Here in Wisconsin, we have seen the emergence of news reports from outlets with ideological agendas and little or no disclosure of who funds the work. That can lead to confusion over what's fact and what's opinion. And trusted news sources are labeled as fake news and their reporters as enemy of the people. Gallup sums it up this way, quote, Americans' trust in the media has been eroding over time, but in the current highly polarized climate, the views of political partisans have become increasingly divergent. President Donald Trump's description of the media as the, quote, enemy of the people has undoubtedly colored the views of all Americans. This goes without saying, but you can't trust everything you read on the internet. And most people in the U.S. are getting their news from social media, which, as you know, is a mishmash of legitimate news, propaganda, and outright garbage. Do you remember Pizzagate? In fact, the internet and social media have become major sources of disinformation, leading to further media trust as explosive quote-unquote stories like the child sex ring run by Hillary Clinton at a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant are contradicted or ignored by mainstream news outlets. This process prompts consumers of actual fake news to distrust real factual news. And this is how a joke became disinformation. This slide comes from one of my colleagues over at the journalism program. There was a satirist in Cleveland who puts these mashups together just for fun. And so he pasted a picture of a big crowd and said, oh, look, these are people going into a Trump rally in Phoenix. Anybody who's been to Phoenix, of course, can look at the green trees and go, probably not. So you ended up with mainstream news organizations saying that that we need to take notice of these massive crowds that are showing up for Trump, that we must, you know, take notice of his great support. But then you've got the Washington Post saying, don't be fooled again. That huge crowd photo is not a Trump rally. The problem with this particular slide is that it came from, or this the meme came from something that looked like the Tennessee Republican Party. that led some media outlets like the Washington Post to say Trump's that the photo to reveal that the photo is a hoax. And that leaves some people feeling like the Republicans were dishonest when in fact the GOP had nothing to do with the meme. It was the Russians. This is another example. In late November, Rolling Stone magazine reported that the author of this account, I Am Tyra Jackson, was the successor to the Russia's Internet Research Agency, which trolled voters in 2016. And this is a heartwarming tweet about an NFL star who found success after tragic childhood and now has paid for 145 houses for single mothers. In late November, they found that the purpose, according to the Rolling Stone's late November article, quote, the purpose of the Tyra account, we believe, was not to spread heartwarming messages to Americans. Rather, the tweet about work done was really a Trojan horse to gain followers and a larger plan by a foreign adversary. In the case of I Am Tyra Jackson, the IRA's goal was twofold: grow an audience in part through heartwarming, inspiring messages, and use that following to spread messages promoting division, distrust, and doubt. This disinformation campaign is often aimed at African Americans. According to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Russian active measures, campaigns, and interference, quote, by far, race and related issues were the preferred target of the information warfare campaign designed to divide the country in 2016. It said 66% of the Internet Research Agency's paid Facebook ads that invoked race were, quote, principally aimed at African Americans in key metropolitan areas. So why target African Americans? The Senate committee concluded that the goal was to weaponize, quote, race, immigration, Second Amendment rights, in an attempt to pit Americans against one another and against their government. But much of our disinformation is homegrown. In 2016, NPR found a purveyor of fake news in suburban LA. The owner of Disinfo Media said he started the company to discredit the quote alt-right, but ended up making money by passing on all kinds of fake stories that were shared and believed by millions of people. NPR found Disinfo Media owner Justin Kohler employed as many as 25 people to write fake stories for clients, most of them on the right side of the political spectrum. He spread fake stories from legitimate sounding websites such as National Report and the Denver Guardian. One story falsely reported that Coloradans were buying marijuana with food stamps. Kohler told NPR, quote, what that turned into was a state representative in the House of Colorado, in the House in Colorado, proposing actual legislation to prevent people from using their food stamps to buy marijuana based on something that had just never happened. Alex Jones's InfoWars is a major purveyor of misinformation. In December, former InfoWars writer Josh Owens wrote a first-person story for the New York Times magazine. He revealed some of the ways in which Jones manipulates his radio listeners with fake and twisted news that seeks to inflame conservatives and boost support for President Donald Trump. Jones convinced many in his audience that the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, in which 20 students and 6 school staff were killed, was a hoax. The dead children and their parents were actors, he claimed, hired by the government to whip up anti-gun sentiment. A retired University of Minnesota Duluth professor was so taken by the story that he wrote an entire book on the quote-unquote hoax. That man was found guilty of defamation and ordered by a Dane County judge to pay $450,000 to the father of one of the children killed in the massacre. In another story about a peaceful Muslim-dominated community in upstate New York, Owens said Jones ordered him and other reporters to paint the people there as terrorists in training, despite what their own reporting had discovered. This type of messaging filters down and up. At one point during the 2016 campaign, Donald Trump claimed that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama actually founded the terrorist organization ISIS. Said Owens, quote, we ignored certain facts, fabricated others, and took situations out of context to fit our narrative, posting headlines like drone investigates Islamic training center, Sharia law zones confirmed in America, InfoWars reporters stalked by terrorism task force, and Obama terror cells in the United States. The rumors are true. Sharia law is here. In Wisconsin, dueling lawsuits are playing out in state and federal courts that could remove more than 234,000 voters from the rolls, or 7% of all registered voters. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty argues the state is required to purge voters who fail to respond to postcards sent to their homes in 30 days. The League of Women Voters and the State Elections Board argue that the program used to identify these voters often flags voters who are not moved or who moved within Wisconsin. Keep in mind, the 2016 presidential election in Wisconsin was decided by less than 1% of vote. Another problem that we've had in Wisconsin is that people in power often do not want, they want to keep the public in the dark. Lafayette County officials considered a resolution that threatened to prosecute media outlets that did not publish news releases from the county word for word. Fortunately, when the extreme measure was brought to national attention, officials abandoned the idea of prosecuting journalists. Especially now, disinformation and misinformation can be used to mislead people, prompting them to make bad, even fatal choices, like failing to abide by social distancing advice or orders, or making trips to grocery stores because they're bored and they don't think this pandemic is real. I'm sharing a slide here from a group called First Draft, which we're working with. It's an organization that is training journalists to identify and avoid spreading disinformation, misinformation, and fake news, which it calls information disorder. Information disorder is not quote-unquote fake news. It's an umbrella term for propaganda, lies, conspiracies, rumors, hoaxes, hyperpartisan content, falsehoods, or manipulated media. First Draft uses the terms disinformation, misinformation, or malinformation. Collectively, it's called information disorder. First Draft also has devised a trumpet of amplification to show how fake and misleading information starts and can be amplified if news organizations are not careful. First Draft advises that journalists be extremely careful with information in the first three categories: the anonymous web, such as 4chan, closed or semi-closed networks, such as chat groups on Facebook, and conspiracy communities, to avoid spreading dis and misinformation that most people have not heard about. But when these conspiracy theories bubble to the surface, it's important to address them. Just last week, rumors that the National Guard was poised to force everyone to stay home prompted the Guard to issue this extraordinary press release detailing the Guard's work to help with elections, transport COVID-19 positive passengers from cruise ships, and help with an understaffed nursing home that had suffered an outbreak. The Guard said, quote, "We have not discussed enforcing statewide quarantines, shutting down interstate highways, nor any of the other baseless rumors that are circulating. Unfortunately, there are nefarious actors, in some cases from other countries, operating in the shadows and intentionally circulating false information and misinformation via social media. We understand that these rumors are part of a concerted disinformation campaign aimed at creating hysteria and panic in our nation's communities." The Guard was reacting to rumors like these, spread by social media, that claimed soldiers would soon be occupying the streets of America for a two-week quarantine. It tells everyone to, quote, "stock up on whatever you need to make sure you have a two-week supply of everything." Such false information can lead people to panic buy, creating shortages of food and essential supplies. In fact, this particular screenshot is from my husband's Facebook messaging feed from one of his brothers. "In any time there's crisis, the hucksters rush in, touting miracle cures. Always consult credible sources when deciding how to treat an illness. I always go to the Mayo Clinic website first." So no silver solution cannot keep you from getting COVID-19. Here's the reality. Not only are we dealing with a worldwide health crisis, but our capacity to provide news keeps shrinking. The number of newspapers is down. The number of reporters covering news is down. Hard-hitting news is too expensive, and the public's trust in the news is declining. At Wisconsin Watch, we provide an antidote to these corrosive trends. We are nonpartisan and nonprofit. We fully reveal all of our funders. Our stories are intensely fact-checked. Our mission is to increase the quality, quantity, and understanding of investigative journalism to foster an informed citizenry and strengthen democracy. Our guiding values are protect the vulnerable, expose wrongdoing, and explore solutions. We tell uncomfortable truths that are sometimes hard to dig out. We revealed that Wisconsin Watch had kept an inmate in solitary for 27 years. We were able to tell his story only after he was moved to the Wisconsin Resource Center, where inmates are allowed to speak to the media. Our stories have impact, and sometimes it's huge. In 2013, we found Wisconsin was declining to take $14 million in federal funding to help people with disabilities get work. After our story ran, Governor Scott Walker reversed the policy and a waiting list of 3,000 people with disabilities was erased. How else do we earn trust? One way is to reveal all of our funders, large and small. As you can see here, WCIJ has a wide base of support from many foundations. Last year, 500 donors supported our work. We also partner routinely with reputable media organizations to bring news you can count on. Our partners include NPR, Wisconsin Public Radio, ProPublica, Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, The Guardian, and many others. In fact, in 2020, we will be partnering with Reveal, APM, and The Guardian to explore disinformation and voter suppression aimed at Wisconsin residents ahead of the presidential election and how secure our voter systems are from hacking. Wisconsin is expected to be ground zero for these efforts. The project Narrow Margin is being reported by 15 UW-Madison journalism students studying investigative reporting under me. We also plan to hire a full-time professional reporter and a public engagement professional to help with Narrow Margin. Watch for these stories later this year. Because of our commitment to transparency in 2018, we were invited to join the Trust Project, a global network of news organizations that pledged to help people assess the credibility of stories they read. Trust Project members commit to ethical practices, inclusive reporting, fact-checking, and correcting errors. We also explain how and why we do stories. For example, in September, I wrote a column explaining why we waited 18 months to tell the story of Roberto, an immigrant allegedly trafficked on a Wisconsin cabbage farm, and the steps we took to protect him from harm. Another way we gain trust is through rigorous fact-checking of our stories. We check each number, we check the spelling of each name, we verify a person's title and affiliations, we use transcripts of taped interviews to make sure quotes are accurate, word for word, and we make sure those quotes are used in the right context. A typical report takes 8 to 12 hours to fact-check. A story on sexual abuse in the Catholic Church in Wisconsin took more than 20 hours. Even veteran reporters like former Wisconsin Watch staff member Bill Leader, seen in the middle there with his dog Stella, go through fact-checking. Here he stands next to 4 years worth of fact-checking files. So how do you know whether the news you read, see, and hear is trustworthy? Here are some things to look for. Are the sources named? If not, why not? Are a range of viewpoints represented? Are key facts in the report confirmed by other news outlets, especially trusted ones? Does the news organization, if nonprofit, reveal how it gets its money so that you can assess whether its stories are truly independent of its funders? Does it promptly correct information that is wrong? Does it cover news from a nonpartisan viewpoint, or is it always from a conservative or liberal point of view? Some final thoughts on how to become a better news consumer. Refrain from spreading misinformation on social media. You know the posts and tweets I'm talking about. Yep, the ones from that relative. Avoid living in a news bubble. Read, listen to, and watch news from diverse sources. If in doubt, check Snopes, PolitiFact, factcheck.org, The Washington Post, or other fact-checking sites. And you can always Google it. Thanks for allowing me to tell our story and sharing how you can make democracy stronger by only reading and sharing real information from legitimate news organizations. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Dee. So I'm going to try to, we'll try to do a, if I can figure out my screen here. I've got it set up, so we'd like to have some talk back here. If you want to ask Dee a question, raise your hand or do the hand in Zoom if you know how to do that, and I will call on you one by one. Rachel, go ahead.
So my husband and I haven't subscribed to our local newspaper for a very long time. When my parents lived in town, we used to look at theirs once in a while, but I didn't think the quality was all that great, and so we just didn't do it. Well, so our local election is coming up next week. We have to vote for school board. We didn't know everybody on the list. And I realized we need some source of information. We went to the internet. We went looking for profiles. We couldn't find anything. So I just decided, okay, it's time. I subscribed. And wouldn't you know, there they were, profiles of our local school board members. And I realized, I have to do this. I have to subscribe. Like, we all need to subscribe to our local papers. and I realized I wasn't practicing what I preached. And so I just wanted to share one of the things we have to do is we all have to not only subscribe to the local paper, but then what I also did was when I didn't see the school board people profiled, I also called them and said, hey, how soon are you going to get these profiles?
Right.
No, I told them what I wanted because how else are we going to get it?
That's a really good point. I couldn't have said it any better. And, you know, as a former newspaper reporter, I now do online and other types of reporting. But yeah, those were thankless but necessary stories, right? You know, profiling all the school board members, profiling. But, you know, we have an information, we have a flood of information, but it's only available to some people because of all the paywalls. And the paywalls were necessary because of the trends I showed you before. The model of how you get money from newspapers has flipped. It used to be subscriptions were a very small part of it, and advertising was the by far the dominant revenue. It is now switched. A lot of news organizations are trying to rely more heavily on their readers to pay for content, but readers are not used to paying that much for content, if anything. So in the internet age. So I appreciate that. Thank you for supporting, I assume, my former colleagues at the Wisconsin State Journal or Cap Times.
Actually, it's Monroe Times in Monroe, Wisconsin.
Monroe, that's exactly right. Well, and they're the only ones who are going to look at your local officials. You know, New York Times is not going to come in and do a profile of your school board race. And Wisconsin Watch, we're not going to do it either. We're an investigative news site. Unless one of them is corrupt or there's some kind of big scandal down there or they're somehow corrupting democracy, we're not going to do it either. So it's very important to support your local news organization.
Great, thanks. Anybody else? I'm trying to look at everybody's screen at once here. Well, I've actually got a question. So one thing that I've noticed in with the social media right now, you know, the disinformation is just rampant.
Oh, yeah.
And the problem is that spammers and trollers don't need to take the time to fact check anything. They just spew all of this stuff out there and it gets spread so quickly, whereas actual fact checking is exhausting and time consuming. Can you speak to anything that can be done about speeding up the process of fact checking?
Yeah, well, it's laborious, as you heard, 8 to 12 hours per story. so it takes a long time for it's along that old saying is that a lie is halfway around the world before the truth gets its shoes on. That is still true right now. What I would do is make sure that not only are you consulting legitimate news organizations, but when you follow people who only circulate factual information.
I would have to unfriend everyone.
Well, maybe some people you might want to unfriend faster than other folks. it's right. And one thing that I've started to do, I don't want to get into fights with family and friends, but I've posted things, and my husband will do this too, just post a link to Snopes saying, yeah, this isn't true. Yeah. Or point to a fact check saying, yeah, that's not really true. Or, you know, post a story from the Washington Post or the New York Times or a local news organization that is really rebutting that. You can sort of fight back a little bit in your own special way without really, it may end up antagonizing some of your Facebook friends, but if they're really your friends and that's all it takes is one bad tweet or one bad post, then maybe they're not your best friends. It's a delicate thing because people do want to believe what they want to believe. And some of these things become a matter of faith, in which case facts do not pierce that. And so it is a difficult thing. We are working with First Draft, which helps. One thing they say, when you're trying to put out correct information or rebut incorrect information, stay respectful, because people will not listen to somebody who is telling them, hey, you're stupid. You're stupid. And that thing you said was stupid. That is the easiest way to shut down a conversation. And so I try to avoid that. I think it's just polite anyway, but if you really want somebody to listen to you, just say, well, here's the context for what you just read. One thing that's happening right now, for example, is people are like, all the projections were off. We were supposed to have 1,500 people dead in Wisconsin by now. So social distancing doesn't work. What they're doing is they're taking projections from before we were doing social distancing that projected if we didn't do social distancing, what might happen. Those projections are not valid. And when you remove the important context from them, you are spreading misinformation, if not disinformation, depending on who. Disinformation is really has an intentionality to it. A lot of what we do accidentally is spread misinformation. So we take disinformation, we think it's real, we spread it going, hey, I saw this on blah, blah. Really just a lot of us can do a lot to practice better hygiene in our own social media habits.
Well, and I just wanted to say my teen was sitting here with me and we were trying to come up with the difference between misinformation and disinformation. And we decided it was intentionality too. So thanks for
it. It is. So misinformation is like if my brother-in-law, what he did, which with that one little message about how the National Guard's going to take over, he didn't start that campaign. He doesn't even know it's real, but he was spreading it. Luckily, he's now learned to spread it in a private message group. Involving his brother who can immediately tell him that's not true. You know, check this, it's not true. So he was engaging in misinformation. He was spreading misinformation. The people who put it out may have also been spreading misinformation, but they might be intentional. Like as the National Guard was saying, they believe this, a lot of this information going out there that's false is disinformation. It's actually created by foreign actors to discredit, to basically get people very upset with the government so that they will not follow when the government says you have to do this. It's creating this body of information that leads people to not heed the stay-at-home orders or other important information.
Mary, go ahead.
Well, one thing I do on Facebook is I have a friend, I inadvertently became his friend, and he's really basically on the other political side than I am, and I keep him as a friend just to find out what's going on the other side and find it valuable from that point of view. And I sometimes I'll respond to something, but not very often.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfectly fine to just sort of troll these, you know, just sit back and see what's being said so you understand where some of these memes are coming from. You know, my husband does the same thing. He scans all the major cable channels, just regardless of their political persuasion, to sort of see what are the talking points, what, you know, who's putting out what information, how factual is it, how twisted is it. I mean, a lot of times misinformation involves actual information that's put out, taken out of context or twisted in a certain way. Say this is happening, therefore that, and those two aren't connected, things of that nature. But I think it's perfectly fine to just sort of sit in the background and watch what people do. But, you know, if you want to take a more active role and, you know, literally it takes 10 seconds to knock down a lot of these crazy rumors, I would suggest doing it so long as you don't antagonize too many people.
Well, one of the things that he recently put up was a list of all the things that kill Americans, you know, like heart trouble and flu and so on, accidents and smoking and this and that, as an opposition, I think, to secreting ourselves in our homes, you know, or keeping ourselves in our homes and quarantining ourselves or staying 6 feet apart. I didn't comment on it, but just noted, you know, in my mind that this is one of the arguments that people are using to debunk the problems of the coronavirus.
Right. And that's, we're actually going to be putting out a story in the next week or so, sort of about these major themes that are going on similar to that, to try to convince people that all the social distancing we're doing is really pointless. And, you know, it's, you know, we should do that for the flu every year is what they're saying. But the difference between that and the flu is we do have a shot for the flu, and we are creating a herd, more of a herd immunity by getting immunized from the flu. And that's important. Whereas with the coronavirus, we can't develop that right now. We don't have it right now. So it is more dangerous than the flu. But again, facts often are inconvenient for people who have a strong belief system that we are being controlled by some deep state, whatever.
And the flu is spread out over, spread out throughout the year. As of a couple of days ago, the coronavirus was the third leading cause of death in the United States. And in New York, it was number one by a large amount. The problem is hospitals being overwhelmed, not the final, final death toll. So,
right. Yeah. It's, it's very difficult because people have things that they consider a matter of faith. There's a former Wisconsin State Journal editor, copy editor, and he is in Missouri now, and he's been posting all this stuff about how social distancing is just a big government orchestrated control measure aimed at what? I'm not sure what they're going to do once they get us all controlled in our houses. It's going to be harder to kill all of us because they'll have to go house to house. But anyway, you don't want to, that would just be too obvious. But anyway, and no amount of facts are really going to budge him off that, even though his own governor for whom he works has now declared a stay-at-home order. I don't know what happens with his belief system then. His guru has now changed his mind. So
we've got just about 5 minutes left in the discussion here. Anybody else?
I have a quick thing. Renee. There
he is. Oh, there. Yeah, do you hear me? Go ahead.
Yep. Okay.
Yes, I have in the past and will continue to call out people on social media with incorrect posts on both sides of political spectrum. I've seen it on both sides. And the thing that's frustrating to me is that I just very nicely post a link to Snopes and say, this is not correct. This is misinformation. This is not correct information. Here's the link. And most of the time, the person that posts will acknowledge it and say, oh, thanks. Or like, oh, thanks for the info. But they don't delete their post. And so then I even saw a couple people commented after my comment saying, like, they didn't read my comment or they skipped over it. And they read the post and said, oh, this is really useful information. Thank you so much. And I was like, so my thing is, if people fact check you, you should take your post down, but I don't know that I can't take their post down. So I just try to politely put the link again to Snopes or one of the fact checking sites and hope that some people see the comment and maybe go to the link, but it is very.
One thing I've used, one strategy I've used is if I am really Facebook friends with them is just send them a private message saying, you might think about taking that down. This could convince some people to make dangerous decisions. And I'd hate to see that.
That's a good thing too.
Then you're not doing public shaming thing.
Yes.
Just going, hey, if you just go to the right, there's a little delete. Yeah. Just delete it so that this bad information isn't getting out there under your name anymore. Because it's not true. It's better that you're not associated with this false information.
That's a good strategy. I think I'll probably try and do the private messaging first to see if I can get
you. Yes. So actually that is the best to do first. And if they acknowledge it, then maybe the post will disappear. If they don't, then just go ahead and post on there saying, hey, this is fake, unfortunately, or something, Snopes, and then move on. That's what I usually do. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Got just a couple minutes left. I'm trying to look at everyone's screens. Holly got something. Oops. Sorry. We keep unmuting each other.
Well, we have will this be a recording? Like if some of our older kids who maybe didn't get a chance to watch it want to watch it?
Yes, Renee is recording this.
Yeah, it's important, I think, for kids to understand this, the ones who are old enough to post and share things, that this is its own kind of virus that gets into our information bloodstream, and it can make all of us kind of sick. Some people really sick, like really, really sick, and those people probably already had some issues beforehand. You look at I was mentioning Pizzagate, somebody actually read that coverage and went to the pizza parlor with a semi-automatic weapon, and could have easily killed a lot of people based on something that was completely made up. So that's the worst case scenario. That's not how most people are going to take this stuff, but it does give them a mindset of distrust. They get looped into conspiracy theories. They make bad decisions for themselves that could affect other people. So it is its own virus that, you know, one way we can do that is to distance ourselves from that bad information and also to try to stop it when we see it happening.
Okay, any last comment before we move on to the offertory?
I just want to thank everybody for taking your time this morning to hear about this. I'm sure you're all very responsible social media users, but, you know, I think we all have a role to play in making sure this stuff doesn't infect our society worse than it already has.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dee. I really, that was a great presentation and so critical right now.
Thanks, everybody. I'm going to sign off. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so our next section here is the music for the offertory. A reminder that we're going to be sharing the donations today with Street Pulse that I talked about earlier. The offertory music is Gymnopedy by Eric Satie. Again, by Amber is playing this, and I'm going to show a picture of a painting called Young Girls by the Sea, which actually inspired this music. So we have a closing song now, and feel free to sing along, but we need everybody to stay muted. If anybody's seen examples of choirs trying to sing through Zoom, it just doesn't work, unfortunately. So our final piece here is called Spirit of Life, and I will be sharing the music with you. Let me just bring that up here. Oh, and Amber is going to, she plays a little intro to this before you can start singing. thanks for Amber for doing the recordings for this. Our closing words today are by Barack Obama and will be read by Barb Park. As soon as I can find her screen, there we go. Go ahead, Barb.
I'm hopeful that despite all the noise, all the lives, we're going to remember who we are, who we're called to be. Out of this political darkness, I see a great awakening. If you vote, things will get better. It will be a start.
Thanks, Barb.